If a friend asks how you're doing, and you say,
I'm okay.
When the truth is,
I don't want my problems to burden anyone.
Or you say,
hang it in there.
Because
if I ask for help, they'll just think I'm weak.
Then this is your sign to call, text, or chat. 988 for free, confidential support. Anytime. You don't have to hide how you feel.
I'm Jonathan Capehart, and this is Cape Up. No, You Shut Up, Speaking Truth to Power and Reclaiming America, is a memoir by Simone Sanders. When we met up for a virtual conversation at the 92nd Street Y in September, Sanders was a senior advisor to Joe Biden's 2020 presidential campaign. Come January 20th, she'll be senior advisor and chief spokesperson to Vice President Kamala Harris. Quite the journey for the young black woman from Omaha, Nebraska, who became well known as the national press secretary for Senator Bernie Sanders, no relation, during his 2016 presidential campaign. We talk all about it and about the incident that inspired the title of her book.
I'm not about to let anybody tell me to shut up on national television. I don't care where I am and what I'm doing.
Get to know Simone Sanders and the lessons she's already learned that she wants young people, especially young women of color, to know right now.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Capehart, opinion writer for The Washington Post and host of the Cape Up podcast at The Washington Post. And it is my pleasure to welcome you to the 92nd Street Y's virtual event, Simone Sanders in Conversation, about her book, No, You Shut Up, Speaking Truth to Power and Reclaiming America. Simone Sanders, welcome to the 92nd Street Y.
Thank you, Jonathan. I'm glad to be here. You know, I thought I'd do this in my little couch situation today because every time I'm at the 92nd Street Y, I just feel like it is a comfy, like, setting where we really settle in and have good, meaty conversation. So I tried to create that environment here today.
All right. Well, let's have that meaty conversation. This book was fun. Your book was fun, and it went in ways that I did not expect. It is memoir. It is it's advice for young people. It's a blueprint, and we're going to get into that in a moment. But I just have to jump in right away. Right now, you are senior advisor to the Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden. Last election cycle, you were the national press secretary for Senator Bernie Sanders in 2016. For myself and everyone who's watching, how did that happen? And I want you to start with Bernie Sanders. Why him in 2016?
So look, I first want to say I am just, again, very grateful to be here. And I love that this is the question you started with, because I know this is the question everybody just really wants the answer to. How did this happen? Well, I will tell you that I went to go work for Senator Sanders in 2015, and I went to work for him because the conversations that he was having out on the campaign trail were the conversations that, frankly, I was having with my friends. I wanted to be able to contribute to what Senator Sanders was saying. And knowing everything that I know right now, given everything that I've experienced, I would make the decision to go back and do it all over again in 2015. I would, if I could go back in a time capsule, I would go back and I'd still make the same decision. I'm proud of the work we did. Mm-hmm. When I made the decision that I wanted to go back out on the campaign trail this cycle, because I was enjoying my time as a political commentator. I used to go to brunch. I used to go on vacations. Now none of those things are happening. Some of that is due to COVID-19 and the current presence of the United States, mismanagement of that situation, which I'm sure we will have an opportunity to touch on later. But some of it is because on the campaign trail, there is no brunch. Okay, there are no vacations. There is work for a finite amount of time, and the clock is ticking. As we are having this conversation, we are yet a couple weeks, a number of weeks, just a couple though, not that many, away from Election Day. And when I made the decision to go back on the campaign trail, I talked to lots of different folks. As you all may remember, there were upwards of more than 20 people running to be the Democratic nominee. And when I had the opportunity to sit down with Vice President Biden and his wife, Dr. Jill Biden, Joe Biden said to me something y'all have heard him say a number of different times. He told me he was running for president because he thought that what he was seeing from Trump was an abuse of power, and he could not sit back and watch an abuse of power go unchecked, that he didn't want to look back on this election cycle and think, what if I would have ran for president? And that was similar to something I had experienced. I didn't want to look back on this cycle and think, what if I didn't jump in? And I told him, I said, me too, sir. And I'm like, but except I want to work for somebody. I don't want to be the president. And then Joe Biden told me that he felt we were in a battle for the soul of the nation, and that he was running and he would be talking about rebuilding the backbone of the country and uniting America. And that struck me because I felt like in that moment that Joe Biden correctly diagnosed what America was actually experiencing. Right now, it seems very clear to us that, yes, we're in a battle for the soul of the nation, given we are regularly having conversations about white supremacy and neo-nationalists and of the sort. It's very clear that we need to rebuild the backbone of the country. You know, currently today, there are 28 million people who have filed for unemployment insurance. It's very clear we need to unite this country and reassert America's position on the world stage. But a year and a half ago, it was not very clear to some people, Jonathan. So I just felt like Joe Biden was right for this moment, right for what America was experiencing. And I'd like to think I made the right decision.
So, okay. But Bernie Sanders was among the 20 some odd people who ran this go round. Why didn't Bernie's message in 2020 that resonated with you so well in 2016, why didn't that work in 2020 for you?
You know, I just felt it was right for this. I felt what Vice President Biden has been saying from the beginning of his campaign and even before, because I spoke to him well before he announced his candidacy, was just right on the nose. This notion that we're in a battle for the soul of this nation, that is currently what we're experiencing and that is what this election is supposed to be about, is something that I didn't hear from any of the other potential candidates that I spoke to in the run-up to this primary. And I believed Joe Biden when he said it. It resonated with me to my core. And frankly, I thought it was something that would resonate with the American people.
Well, one thing, it resonated with, his message resonated with the American people. He is now the Democratic presidential nominee. But the announcement that you went to Biden's campaign resonated certainly with the political class and the political journalism class, who are like, whoa, this is big. What does that mean? How did you feel when the decision you made was actually news?
I was surprised. I didn't expect so many people to be so interested in, my career selection and my latest job choice. I absolutely was because, you know, I am I'm a habitual campaign staffer. Politics is something that is important to me. I'm passionate about it, but politics is what I do. It is literally how I pay my bills. This is my job. And I am just fortunate to have a job that helps, you know, move and push the conversation forward in this country. And that is literally about making people's lives better. In my opinion, that's what politics is all about. And that's why I do campaigns, because I sign up to work for candidates that fundamentally at the end of the day will help make the lives better for the people they are running and hoping to represent. I was surprised by it, but I'm just out here trying to do a good job for Joe Biden. And that's what I thought in April of 2019. And that's what I think right now. You know, I had no idea that we would be conducting we'd be running, frankly, in a general election in a pandemic, that this election is happening on the backdrop of a global pandemic. And every single day we're learning something new. But I think that given that there's just so many things we have to be focused on. So way back in April of 2019, at the moment, I was focused on banding together with my colleagues, as every other week somebody in the media wrote our campaign's obituary. Yeah. And said that, you know, Joe Biden is finished. He's on his way out. It's just a number of days or weeks before his campaign collapses. And we are still here. And we're here frankly, for the reason that I articulated moments ago, is that Joe Biden knew what America was going through. He knew what America needed. The message that he has right now in this general election, as we sit here in September, is the message that he started this race with. I think he was right.
I just want to go on record that I was not one of those political journalists.
You were not. You were not.
Because I was like, it's not over until the black people talk.
This is true.
And it proved true. So I want to explain why I started out putting you on the spot, having you talk about why Bernie and then why Biden and why did you do that? Because it all goes back to what you wrote, and it's on page 28 of your book, where you write, "Look at me. I'm just me, a bald black girl from Omaha, Nebraska, with vision and ambition and a belief that I can do something important to change the state of the world. If I can infiltrate the apparatus, you can too." When reading your book, you have and you had life goals and ambitions. And I don't even think that the young Simone Sanders in Omaha ever thought that she would be talked about in this way. You can have the vision and the dream, but then to actually live it. How has it been to be that person?
to be that person. Jonathan, you make it sound so just lofty. And you know what? I view the things that I've done in my career and the decisions that I've made, I view them as the things that were necessary. I view that as me playing my part. Okay, and my part is to help get really good people elected and to help push democracy forward. And I am here working on the Biden campaign because I fundamentally believe that a Joe Biden presidency will help save lives, one, and will two, really, not just put us back on track to where we were before, but build back better, as Joe Biden likes to say.
Right.
So it is, I think I couldn't have, people always ask me, could you have imagined, like, did you know? And I'm like, no, I didn't know. Did y'all know? Okay. Who? I am 30. No, I didn't know. But I'm very happy and blessed and humbled to be here. And I know that I wouldn't be able to do the work that I do, or even colleagues of mine, such as, you know, Ashley Allison or Corinne Jean-Pierre or Ashley Etienne. We are able to do the work that we do because of people like Donna Brazil and Mignon Moore and Yolanda Caraway and Reverend Leah Daughtry, the colored girls who came before us, who put in the work in politics behind the scenes, many of them for so many years, pulling the levers of power, pushing and ensuring that our perspectives are represented in the room, the perspectives of women, the perspectives of black women, the perspectives of people who were not originally in the we, ensuring that we are in the room so we have the ability to be seniors, advisors, and spokespeople now in 2020.
Okay, so you use one of the words, because now I want to dive into the book, because there's a lot going on in your book, and the word we. Let's go through some definitions. You start out the book by talking about we. Define we.
Well, who is we? I write in the book about the preamble to the Constitution. In the preamble to the Constitution, it says, we the people, in order to form a more perfect union. But when they wrote that, Jonathan, the we was not you and the we was not I, okay? The we didn't include anybody here in this conversation. The we was rich white men. You had to be rich and white. You couldn't just be white. You had to be rich and white. And I think throughout history, the we has expanded. In this, when I originally wrote the book, I had no intention, frankly, to go out on the campaign trail. So I was like, I might as well write a book about what's going to happen next year. And now I'm here and it's like, what is that? What is going on? But when I wrote the book, thinking about this moment that we're in, this presidential election that was upon us, coming out of the midterm elections that had just happened, I thought about the fact that where we currently sit in politics is this we, the people, who are unlikely voices. Because, you know, now the we is young people, the we is our women of all backgrounds, the we is men, the we are activists, whether we're talking about Sunrise activists or, frankly, Tea Party activists on the right, whether we're talking about Black Lives Matter, the we are all these unlikely voices that are pushing and really directing the conversation that we're having as a country. and the conversation we're having in politics, and this understanding who the we is or who we're talking about, frankly, and as I write in the book, that we're trying to pull together these unlikely coalitions to help create change is really important. So I thought if I needed to start out the book talking about and defining the we, the expansive we that we're trying to get to, because this is a concept I hit on throughout the rest of the writing, and really it gets to the heart of engaging unlikely voices and unlikely people in politics.
And then the next definition is, so you've got the we, and you've defined who the we are. Now, what you advise the we to do is to infiltrate, get in on, break into the apparatus.
Yes.
Define the apparatus.
The apparatus. Well, you know, so Jonathan, I'd like to credit my students, okay? I taught a class at USC in the spring of 2019, and I taught a class, I was a spring fellow at Harvard at the Institute of Politics. And this whole concept of the apparatus and the we, I credit my students because I had to teach these classes about politics, and I was like, how can I explain this? So this is the what we came up with in class. And the apparatus is the machine, if you will. And there's a political apparatus in this country. And when people talk about the Democratic Party, what they're really talking about is a Democratic Party apparatus. Apparatus are the elected officials, the party committees, the donors, the machine that makes up what we think of as a Democratic Party. But what fuels the apparatus, what fuels the machine are the factions. And if we took time, Jonathan, we could put 150 factions. If I had a whiteboard, we'd do 150 factions on this whiteboard. And the factions are the various groups. Now, if we did this for my Republican friends, we maybe have three factions. In my opinion, you've got your conservative, your traditional conservatives, your Tea Party Republicans, and your Trump Republicans. At one point in time, the Tea Party Republicans were apparatus adjacent. They were not they were not something that fueled the machine. They operated adjacent to outside of the machine that is the Republican Party. But over time, they've infiltrated the apparatus, and now they're a core part of the Republican Party. So much so that when Republicans were in charge of the United States House of Representatives, you know, the Republicans couldn't get anything done without checking the box at the Freedom Caucus. Talk about infiltration. So I think that this idea of the apparatus, understanding when we say Democratic Party, what we're talking about, who we're talking about, and what fuels and moves the party is important, because the apparatus is where the power sits. The apparatus, you know, the party committees, the elected officials, donors, this is the power. Traditionally, though, the apparatus, it did not look diverse. The apparatus is not young. There was not a diversity of a large array of diversity of thought. But over the years, the apparatus has begun to change. Now, people might argue the apparatus has not changed nearly as quickly on the Democratic side of the aisle as it should. And there are people who are apparatus adjacent who will say that this apparatus has not even changed at all. It looks the same thing as it looked 50 years ago. But I would argue that the apparatus is in fact changing. And the way, I think the most effective way to make the apparatus reflect the people is in fact to infiltrate the apparatus.
Hey there, I'm Dr. Maya Shunker, and I'm a scientist who studies human behavior. Many of us have experienced a moment in our lives that changes everything, that instantly divides our life into a before and an after. On my podcast, A Slight Change of Plans, I talk to people about navigating these moments. Their stories are full of candor and hard-won wisdom. And you'll hear from scientists who teach us how we can be more resilient in the face of change. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Those are the two primary concepts in your book, the we and the apparatus. And what you do is you then weave your story in and out of talking about that. What you do also in your memoir is basically give life advice to, I suppose you're talking to peers of yours, but also younger people. And one of the things you say, and this has been I'm almost twice your age, Simone, but we end up saying, I'm reading your book and I'm like, yeah, I've been saying the same thing. And one of them is, I didn't do this. You wrote down all of your goals.
Yes.
You have goals for the year, goals for 5 years, big life goals, and then as a way of holding yourself accountable. Why did or do you think it's important that people write their goals down?
Well, for me, I started writing my goals down because it kept me focused on the things that I needed and wanted to do. And it was especially important when I first moved to Washington, D.C. You know, I'm from Omaha, Nebraska, North Omaha, to be specific. And when I moved here, I literally moved here just to do politics. I didn't have family in the area. I had a couple friends that I went to college with that now lived here and were in law school. But I moved here to do politics. And it was really important for me during this time in my life to make sure I had the outline, as I like to call it, because it's not a script, okay? We don't need to stick, we just need to write down the broad goal. We don't know how we're gonna get there, just the broad goal, and then hold ourselves accountable on filling in the details. But it was important for me that I wrote that down, because every single time that something happened that tried to potentially take me away from politics, I had to remind myself that this was the only reason I was here. This is why I came. And if is this what I still believe, or has it changed? Mm-hmm. And if it has changed, great, then we need to update the outline. But if it hasn't changed, then we need to get back focused. And so I think for so many people out there, writing down what it is that you say you want helps make it real for you. And then you have to start saying it in various ways. And so people say, oh, don't tell people your dreams, so kill them. Where some people you cannot tell your dreams to, because they are dream killers, okay? Yep. Mm-hmm. There are dream killers out there, but it is very important. I think there's power in telling your truth. And even if it's broad, saying, you know, well, one day I'd like to be an author. One day I'd like to, heck, be a ballerina. One day I'd like to be a doctor. One day I'd like to, you know, backpack across Europe. Whatever your goal is, speaking it makes it real. Mm-hmm. And then it's also holding you further accountable, because now you've told people. So you're going to do what you said you're going to do? I don't know.
Right. And as you write in your book, saying it out loud gives it oxygen. And in order for it to live and become true, it needs the oxygen. I remember doing an event in Minnesota for my college, Carleton College in Northfield, Minnesota. And one of the young graduates was there, and he is, I'm assuming he's still at Minnesota Public Radio. And he was just starting his career, and he was asking me career advice. And I asked him, what's your dream job? And he sort of hesitated, but I could see that he had one. And I looked at him and I said, no, say it. Say it out loud. Give it life. You need to do it. People think it's, you know, goony goo goo crazy, but it's true. It is absolutely
true. It's so true.
You are proof of it.
It is so true.
I'm proof of it. And don't let people kill your dreams. Now, the other thing.
Don't let them do it.
So you've got, and everybody, Simone keeps her outline, she says, in the notes function on her phone.
I do. It's in the notes function of my cell phone, okay? Right. Password protected, so the Russians can't get it, all right?
So it's always ever handy and ever present. But you also then say, okay, great, you've got your goals. Now, like, how do you go about being prepared? I think you had an interview with a politician, but you didn't have technical writing experience. So you set out to get technical writing.
Yes, yes. It was Maxine Waters told me straight up that, you know, I was very lovely, but I needed technical writing experience to work in her office. And I was great, but I need to go get some technical writing experience because, you know, the Financial Services Committee, they don't play. And I was like, oh, well, okay, I need to find technical writing experience, I guess. What I have is not technical. So thank you to Maxine Waters and her then chief of staff, Twan Samuels, because it was a very straightforward lesson.
And so you went off and decidedly it was not politics, but you did learn a lot. I'm trying to remember, it was so technical that I can't, I was like.
I worked for a consumer advocacy think tank and the global trade division.
Global trade.
Trade is as technical as you can get.
Correct. But it was as a result of that job that made it possible for you. Eventually, it made you an asset over in the world of Bernie Sanders.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I didn't know, obviously, when I took the trade job, I was just trying to, you know, get a job in D.C. And they hired me. I was like, look, I don't know anything about trade, but I can write and I do communications. And when I eventually ended up working on the Sanders campaign, you know, in the throughout the primary, you know, TPP and issues of trade, it became a mainstream issue. And I just remember working at the consumer advocacy think tank, calling up bookers for shows, you know, trying to get my then boss on. And they were saying, you know, trade is not sexy and the people don't know about trade, Simone. We're not talking about trade. You know, if you want to, you know, give me something about education, give me something about business, trade's not sexy. And then boom, 2015 comes. We're in this primary and all of a sudden trade becomes sexy. They're booking all kinds of people on TV to talk about trade. And we were having conversations internally and there were conversations I could contribute to because I spent, you know, almost a year working on these issues as a communications person. And I like doing communications because that's where you, I mean, the communications people have to take the very technical information and synthesize it into talking points to communicate out to the rest of the world. So I spent a lot of time with some very smart people saying, okay, explain this to me again. And that was an asset for me when I went onto the campaign trail.
Another thing you write about in your book. Okay, so you had that meeting with Maxine Waters and she was like, baby doll, you're nice, but you don't have technical writing experience. You went off and you got that technical writing experience. Another thing you write about in your book is you had an opportunity to go to Deloitte. You had something like 26 interviews. You got
yes.
all the time. And a friend of yours said, hey, you know, if you wanted to work at Deloitte, I can get, you can get a job at Deloitte. And yet you didn't go down that route. Explain why it was important for you to tell that story in your book.
Was important. It is that story is an actual demonstration of what I say when what I mean when I say, you know, keep your outline and your outline keeps you focused. Obviously, I moved to DC to do politics. Obviously, Deloitte is not, well, it is political, but it is in fact not politics, honey.
Right.
So
pays well though.
Pays well, very well, okay, very well. Better than some of the things I was working on, okay? Way, way better. But is that what I wanted to do? And I think that story was important for me to put into the book because I think there are times in everyone's career, whether you are a young person or you've been at this 25, 30 years, where you will be presented with unlikely opportunities that have nothing to do with the path that you set out on. And that is an opportunity for you to make a decision. Do I want to go down this divergent path? Maybe this is a sign. Maybe this is what I'm supposed to be doing. Or do I want to stay focused on the thing that it is that I said I wanted and stick this out and see what happens here? I decided to stick it out and I think it worked out okay for me. And I hopefully that'll be a lesson for other people.
Another thing, I brought up the Deloitte story because it gets to, even though you don't tie it to this, but you later on in the book talk about knowing yourself and having, knowing your boundaries and having values and how that can help you also keep you centered, focused, moored in a sense. Talk more about the importance of knowing yourself.
No, I mean, when I, you know, I'm 30, Jonathan, okay? So I just found myself a couple years ago, but.
Wait, Simone, you'll keep finding yourself. Trust
me. I just really found myself a couple of years ago. And I think it takes people a long time because once you realize who you really are, once you become comfortable with yourself, I think you are more willing to take risks. You are more willing to say no. You know what you would like to say yes to. You're not afraid to ask for what it is that you deserve and you know that you work for. So I think knowing yourself is really important, but it's a process. And sometimes it takes, you know, you reach that point at various levels. But I would tell you when I, you know, really got to know myself and, you know, found my voice, as I like to say, a thing that I realized is that it is really important to have boundaries. And I wish that, you know, growing up, someone gave me just this straightforward lesson about having professional boundaries. We teach lessons about personal boundaries, right? But we don't teach, in my opinion, enough lessons about professional boundaries, about knowing what it is that you will and won't do at work. What can someone get you to say? What can someone get you to do? Is there a project you are unwilling to work on? Are there tactics you are unwilling to use? And if you are confronted with this situation that crosses the professional line you have drawn for yourself, do you know what you're going to do? And I think I also talk about needing a personal line as well, because there are times where, I mean, look, we've all been in the workplace. We've all been on panels, okay, with people who you're like, okay, okay, what do you do? I mean, there's a quote, if you don't stand for something, you'll fall for anything. And so you need to know what your personal and professional boundaries are, but also you have to know what you will do when someone crosses those boundaries. And the title of my book is No, You Shut Up. I was once sitting on a cable news panel and a co-panelist told me to shut up. Okay, he crossed my boundary, he crossed my line, and I'm not about to let anybody tell me to shut up on national television. I don't care where I am and what I'm doing. You will not tell me to shut up, so you can shut up, is what I exactly said.
Yes, that was Rick Santorum, if I remember.
No, that was our dear friend Ken Cuccinelli.
Oh, yes.
Who works for the lovely Trump administration. I get the two mixed up because... Yes.
Okay, moving right along. This is from your chapter, Redefining Normal. And this is under one of the things that Simone does in her books, like she's telling you her story, and then the font and everything changes, and then it becomes piece of advice.
Yes. In the audiobook, I changed my voice. I was like, piece of advice. They said, get familiar. I said, okay, now y'all need to hold on. What is familiar now?
So this is under a word on how you look and who you are. And in this, you say, if I waited on someone to pick me, I'd be waiting for a really long time. And I probably wouldn't be talking to you in this book. I'm fully aware that when I show up curvy with a low cut, a bold lip, an oversized bow, amazing nails, and a chilling analysis, people don't know how to take it because I'm not supposed to be able to give you solid political commentary with a bedazzled nail, right?
I do have a bedazzled nail.
And I saw that, which is why I wanted to read this section. There's a lot going on here. There's presentation, but there's also how not just your presentation in terms of the bedazzled nail and the bold lip and all that, but just being a Black woman, being Black, being mm-hmm. a Black woman, and then being a young Black woman, and how that all three of those things conspire to keep people from taking you seriously. Mm-hmm. Talk more about that. And what advice would you give to people, men and women? Because there was some advice in here, Simone. Again, like I said before, I'm almost twice her age. And I was like, oh, I'll make a note of that. That's good advice. Talk more about that.
Well, look, I'll answer the last part of your question first. I have for the things that I've done that people know about. So working for Senator Sanders, now working for the Biden campaign, being a political commentator on CNN. I am usually, in each of those instances, I'm usually the youngest person in the room.
That's gonna change, Simone.
That's gonna change, hopefully. It's changed now. I was in a meeting the other day and they were like, well, you know, y'all Gen, I said, hold up, y'all Gen who? Y'all millennials. I said, how old are you? Hold on now. Y'all trying to call me old. The children are now calling me Auntie Simone on my Instagram. And I am like, wait, guys, I'm not an auntie yet. What? So I apparently have transitioned. So maybe that'll help me in my next meeting. So I'm now a part of the auntie crew. But up until now, I was one of the youngest people in the room. And I will tell you, what I learned early on is that, yes, to your point, because I am the youngest person in the room, and oftentimes because people are not used to seeing people that look like me occupy the spaces that I've occupied, people assume that I don't necessarily know what I'm talking about. I had people tell me in 2015, 2016 that, well, they were very sure I was only there because Senator Sanders was having issues with the African-American community, and they just hired a random Black girl to be the press secretary to fix those issues for optics, not because I knew the role. And I was like, oh, I need to leave this restaurant situation because we are confused. But that's, people believe that. So I learned early on that I have to ensure that I have the facts, that I come to the conversation with data, that I am, you know, backing up what I'm saying with factual information and citing sources so that I can be believed, for lack of a better term. And it ended up coming in handy because when you're on television, as you well know, You always need a little psych. You need some facts to back up what you're saying when you're speaking to millions of people. And I've taken that into, you know, every workplace that I've ever had. But it is jarring to me the ways in which people will tell you what you cannot do. When I left the, I write about this in the book, when I left the campaign in 2016, I didn't know what I was gonna do. I ended up though, I was still doing television. And I thought, oh, well, I see people are getting paid to do this. They keep asking me, maybe I too can get paid. And I set out, people told me I needed an agent. So I went out to look for an agent and a couple agents told me a number of different things. Someone told me I needed voice lessons because I didn't sound like what people were used to hearing when they turned on the television and watched the news. Someone told me that, you know, oh, well, someone straight up told me I was just not gonna get a contract at all. Someone else told me I wasn't palatable enough for cable television, and that palatable was very loaded. I didn't know if I was too black, too big, too loud. I was unsure about what not palatable meant. But if I listen to all those folks, we probably wouldn't be sitting here having this conversation. So it is just really important that, in my opinion, and the advice I would give to young people especially is don't let anyone tell you what you can do. You need to show them. You need to, you know, ask for what it is that you want. Go after the things that you know you deserve and that you work for. But you need to be able to perform when you get there. And I think, you know, we've all known folks who have gotten into various places and spaces, and then they get to the job and they can't perform. So as a young person, especially, I have to be able to perform when I get there because, you know, it could be the last rodeo for all young people coming after me if I don't do well.
So Simone, I swear, sometimes I think we're the same person because in the story, you write about how when someone asks you for what you want, tell them. Yes. Because you never know what they're going to say. They could actually say yes. And I had that situation in my own career. And that's what happened with you when you had the interview with Jeff Weaver, campaign manager for Bernie Sanders in the 2016 cycle. And he asked you, what do you want? You said, I want to be national press secretary.
Exactly. Now, did I think they were going to make me the national press secretary? I don't know. But it was the job that I would like to have. And if you're going to ask me what I would like, I'm going to tell you what I want. I'm going to let you tell me no. And I think that, Jonathan, you and I, we're very clear that we should just, you know, we're going to let people tell us no. Okay. You're not going to wonder what it is that I want. I'm going to ask for. But there are so many people out there who are not asking for what it is that they know that they've worked for and that they deserve. They ask for the thing right up under it because they believe that's the thing that people will give them, that is the thing that's more palatable and digestible, and more feasible. It's kind of like that question of like, what do you want for dinner? And sometimes, we know what we want for dinner.
Question though.
Jonathan, you know what you want for dinner. Sometimes though, what you want for dinner, it might be cheesecake, okay? It might be that restaurant where you know you're not supposed to be eating because of the calories. It might be, you know, it might be you're not hungry. But I think we know what we want for dinner, so just say it. You just might get it.
You know, you write something else in your book and when it comes to women, and that is, women are all nice. Mm. Adjective of being nice. And you're like, forget that. I don't care if you think I'm nice. Why is it important that that women especially, but this is broad advice that you give, but why should women not worry about being nice?
I will tell you, I think frankly, women are the only people in the workplace that are thinking about or even given the advice that you should be thinking about being a nice person at work. Men are told to be assertive. They're told to think about being hardworking. They're encouraged, you know, to be go-getters and to be aggressive. And if you are a woman, it's like, oh, but are you, I think you need to be concerned about how nice you are. How do you come off? And I think at the end of the day, what matters is your work product. And what matters, like, I think being nice hinders the concept of niceness, the concept of being nice in the workplace is literally only something we say to women, as I just described. So it hinders you. I think that I want to be kind, right? I don't want anybody to think that I'm a terrible person to work with. I would like to have an enjoyable work experience and I want people to have an enjoyable work experience working with me, but I don't care if you think I'm nice. So I'm not here to be nice. I'm here to be effective. And so I don't know if nice is a term that people use to describe me at work, anyone who's ever worked with me, but I do think what they say is I'm effective. I think what they say is I'm assertive. I think what they say is that I'm a team player. They probably don't say I'm nice. I think they also might say sometimes I'm a little loud. But I'm nice is not a word they use, and nice isn't a word I need them to use. What we should be worried about is being effective, being good team players. Sometimes that requires you not to be nice.
Right. And so, you know, when I read that part in the book, it took me to what happened during the vice presidential search. And the story that came out, I guess maybe a week or two before Kamala Harris, Senator Harris, was named as the vice presidential nominee, where someone on the search committee apparently said, this came out by way of friends of this person, that this person had a problem with Senator Harris because she didn't show any remorse about the June debate. And then the uproar came about, why does she have to show remorse? Show a man running for president. Oh, and that she's also too ambitious. She's so ambitious. And it's like, show a man who's running for president who's not ambitious, or who ran for president is not ambitious, a vice president who's not ambitious. Isn't that part of the job?
This is why we still have work to do, Jonathan. This is why there's still work to do out there in the world. I will say this, Udell, as our campaign manager, John Miley Dillon, tweeted at the time of this hubbub about ambitious women. And as Senator Harris herself said, when she, in her first public remarks after she was announced as Vice President Biden's running mate, she stands on the shoulders of a long line of ambitious women. We all do. They're ambitious women that I work with every single day. And as General Miley Dillon said, whoever our running mate is going to be, you'll be damn sure that she's an ambitious woman. Well, I think we got that with Senator Kamala Harris. And there's just double standards. You know, Donna Brazile taught me a lesson a couple years ago that I have never forgotten. And the crux of the lesson is that the isms aren't going away tomorrow. Not sexism, not racism, not ageism, not ableism. The isms are not going away tomorrow. We have to call it out when we see it. We need to work to eradicate them. We need to work every day to combat them. Like it is a constant battle, but we also have to figure out how to navigate through the isms. And it's a lesson that obviously as a young Black woman, I'm still learning every single day. And you know, sexism is real. Racism is very real. Ageism is very real. But we cannot allow the isms to block us from the work, because being able to navigate through the isms is the way and is part of how we can eventually eradicate them.
We're getting to the end of our time together, which I cannot believe so much time has gone by. So let's come back to the beginning, and that's the 2020 presidential campaign. Do you think that President Trump's sort of campaign of fear that he's waging, will it work? And campaign of fear directed squarely at white voters. And we know the power of whiteness and the power of white supremacy. Even in 2020, your view of how effective that kind of campaign will be.
So look, I think that we don't have to guess on if the president's campaign of fear is working, we can look at the polls. And if you look at the polls, voters across battleground states trust Joe Biden the most to keep them safe. They trust Joe Biden to handle the very pressing issues as it relates to what's happening, the various crises that we're experiencing in this country. Now, I think President Trump's and the Trump campaigns, and I would argue the Trump administration's campaign of fear and their message of they're trying to scare people. They're trying to scare people from going to the polls. They're trying to scare people into supporting the president with this kind of law and order message. And it makes me laugh because I wonder if Donald Trump remembers that he is in fact the president. And you know, talking about like, you know, in Joe Biden's America you won't be safe. Well, hold on, sir. With all due respect, this is Donald Trump's America, and we are not safe now. We're not safe from COVID. It's not safe for folks to send their children into schools and know for a fact that there will be no danger that will come to them in places all across this country this month. People are having schools in their living rooms and their kitchen tables and corners in their bedrooms that they've converted into makeshift classrooms because the president has failed to put a plan together to mitigate the coronavirus. You know, folks aren't safe from the president inciting violence in this country. So the real question I think that voters should ask themselves is, in fact, are you safe in Donald Trump's America? And we would argue that the answer is no. Look around, look at what's happening. Donald Trump has been president for 4 years, and he's been managing this COVID-19 pandemic for 8 months, and we still don't have a plan to mitigate this virus. We still have yet to see his infrastructure plan, even though it's been infrastructure week, Jonathan, since the beginning of the administration. So ask yourselves, ladies and gentlemen, who do you want to send back to Washington, D.C.? Who do you want in the White House? Joe Biden and Kamala Harris is our answer.
Simone Sanders, earning your keep as a senior advisor to the Democratic presidential nominee, Joe Biden. You were here talking about your new book, No, You Shut Up, Speaking Truth to Power and Reclaiming America. There is so much more in this book that we could not get to, that I wish we could have talked about, that time you got arrested.
Oh, yeah.
Which was actually rather scary, that time that a person on the campaign stood in the gap and took care of you, and why that's important. So if you want to know what those stories are, pick up Simone Sanders' book. In the meantime, Simone, good luck and be safe on the campaign trail.
Thank you, Jonathan. It's always good to see you, and hopefully we will see you soon. I know I've been seeing you on my TV, okay? So if I don't see you in person, I will be watching you, my friend.
Thanks for listening to Cape Up. Tune in every Tuesday. You can find us on Apple Podcasts and Stitcher. And how about doing me a huge favor? Subscribe, rate, and review us. I'm Jonathan Capehart of The Washington Post. You can find me on Twitter at CapehartJ.
If a friend asks how you're doing, and you say,
I'm okay.
When the truth is,
I don't want my problems to burden anyone.
Or you say,
hang in there.
Because
if I ask for help, they'll just think I'm weak.
Then this is your sign to call, text, or chat. 988 for free, confidential support. Anytime. You don't have to hide how you feel.